cold outside.
I've got to go away.
Bet it's cold out there.
Yep, it has been cold out there, and we'll talk about it during this installment of Jet Streaming, produced by Minnesota Public Radio.
Betty, it's cold outside.
The answer is no.
I say it's cold out there.
Much of the nation has been downright chilly, with some areas of the Deep South experiencing colder and snowier weather than was seen at Christmas. The snow and the cold may be getting to some people, but not you guys here with me. Good to see you all again.
Good to be back, Kathy.
Morning, Kathy. Hi, Kathy.
Mark Seely is professor of climatology at the University of Minnesota, joining us two certified, or, I don't know, certifiable meteorologists.
Both, I think, apply.
Paul Huttner and Craig Edwards. Paul, I think this is your first trip on Jet Streaming, isn't it?
Well, you know, I saw it going, and I thought I'd jump on for a ride.
Please,
looks great.
Please do. Paul and Craig are staff meteorologists here at Minnesota Public Radio, and I'm Kathy Werzer. The cold comes in the wake of one of the major weather-related stories to hit this week, gentlemen. The IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's report on global warming on a regional level, is out. If you want evidence of global warming, well, look no further than your own backyard. Michigan, folks in Michigan are seeing animal species never before seen in that state. Lake Superior is famously chilly. Waters are warming up, due in part to a lack of ice cover during the winter. Wisconsin's climate could be more like Arkansas, according to this report. What do you all make of this?
Well, I think it's an interesting situation we have going, particularly here in Minnesota, because I was looking at the report, and it says, the headline says, widespread hunger, drought, floods, and death. And then they said, that's the watered-down version. And I'm thinking, have we got people's attention on this or not?
I would add, Kathy, IPCC report aside, I think there's been a convergence of opinion, especially in the mid to high latitudes, of the citizenry as they've observed real consequences and changes in the environment around them over the last decade or two. And I think that that's making the public more receptive to the IPCC report, which is an eloquent and carefully crafted narrative. There's no doubts about that. But it's really substantiating the observations that a lot of people have seen in the last decade or two.
Paul Huttner?
Well, what's fascinating to me is that we are seeing these changes in our lifetime. This is happening in front of people's eyes, and people are noticing, especially in the mid and high latitudes, these changes, in fact, are happening right in front of their eyes. We talk about Lake Superior. 4.5 degrees of warming with summertime temperatures since 1979. That's a significant change, warming much faster than the surrounding land areas. Lake Superior, the largest freshwater body in the world by surface area, and that's going to have big impacts over time. It'll change the species in the lake. It'll change the evaporation rates, and that's going to happen on all of the lakes, especially at the mid and high latitudes. So big changes. Nobody knows, I think, yet we really haven't grasped how we're going to deal with this and what the specific effects are going to be. One of the interesting economic things that I look at is the next billionaires on the planet are the ones who are going to figure out how to take advantage of climate change. I don't know how that's going to happen, but we know capitalism. Somebody will figure it out.
Hey, I want to bring another voice into this conversation. He's on the phone, Dr. Brian Schumann. He's a paleoclimatologist at the University of Minnesota. He studies global warming trends using samples of lake sediment. Brian Schumann, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Pretty well.
Good. Well, what are some of your thoughts on the IPCC recent report?
Well, it's really interesting to see it because my perspective is from looking at past climate changes. And, of course, most of these are, well, they are natural changes that have occurred in the past. And it's interesting to put, you know, that past perspective out there when you're thinking about what could happen in the future. You know, we hear numbers like that temperatures might warm by 1 to 3 degrees over a whole century, and maybe that doesn't sound like a whole lot. But what concerns me is that if you go back to the past and look at time periods like at the end of the last ice age, when temperatures warmed by that same amount, say 3 degrees in a century, there were massive ecological changes. Large numbers of species would die off in a given area to be replaced then by new species. And you know, that's the type of thing that could have big impacts for our society. If, you know, imagine the forests in Minnesota dying back and having to be replaced by something else that would grow here. That'd radically change the way, you know, our life is in Minnesota. So it's I don't know. I'm actually, I've become a little bit more, alarmed by what I think could happen in the future. I don't want to be too much of an extremist here, but I think it is something that we need to think seriously about. It's a long-term change that's in front of us. We're beginning to see it happen now, but it will continue for a long time.
That's the same sense I get with people that know me in 35 years of doing the weather, and particularly with people that know me well, like my daughter says, Dad, knowing what you know and what you've observed about climate change, why isn't there a little bit more passion, a little bit more urgency in your voice about what you're seeing with changes? And my first concern is to build up some credibility and some advocacy and people trusting me that when I say I'm a voice for climate change, that I don't come off as one of these alarmists, but I come across as a realist, and that I do have an opportunity to motivate people to change their lifestyle.
This is one of the things I always tell my students is that they should look ahead at the future in a way as an opportunity to be leaders and to face the fact that this report says no matter what happens, we're already locked into a certain amount of change, so we at least have to begin to adapt to that.
But how much of this is adaptation versus mitigation?
Well, it's certainly clear that you cannot just adapt to this. We could try, but I think there's some pretty big limits there. And one of the important things, in my view, is how fast do things change? And we have some bit of a choice on that right now. If we try to mitigate some of the release of greenhouse gases, we could slow down the rate of change. And I think that would be really important because, as I said, when you look at the past, you see time periods in the past when temperatures warmed, say, 3 degrees in a century, and that had big ecological effects. But at times when it warmed, say, 1 degree in a century, the effects were much more subtle and were not as sort of necessarily devastating. And so if we have the choice now between really major changes versus more gradual changes that we have time to adapt to, I think it's really important to put in place some mitigation. It's, as someone said to me recently, it's sort of like driving your car and suddenly realizing you're about to hit something. Do you hit it at full speed or do you put the brakes on and try to slow yourself down, even if you know you're going to hit it no matter what? It's trying to, remove the risk.
Brian, if I can, I'd like you to amplify on something that you're familiar with as a researcher, which is disturbance and the local scale effects of a landscape disturbance. It occurs to me in the IPCC report that when they start talking about consequences, they've emphasized, particularly in the Northern Hemisphere, the widespread changes occurring in the high latitude positions and the loss of permafrost, so that now we're going to have biogeochemical cycling going on in those soils that have been permanently frozen for centuries. We've got migration of the tree line in Canada. We've got loss of habitat for those that have made their living on the ice. There's all kinds of things going on at high latitude, and I wondered if you can share any thoughts on that.
Yeah, it is really interesting to look at not just sort of the direct effects of, say, things warming and therefore species moving north, but also then some of these more complicated responses that can happen. I mean, it is really interesting to realize that we've been storing for 10,000 years all this carbon that's frozen in the ground, in the soils, in the peatlands up north. And as that warms, then you begin to allow decomposition to occur. And there's a whole number of these interesting kind of surprising feedbacks that can happen. You can warm the soils, that will lead to the release of more carbon dioxide. But you could do other things too. For example, warming conditions allows new insects to migrate up north, and those devastate the forests. This has been happening in Alaska. The warming conditions or drier conditions could also lead to more fires, and this leads to rapid changes in the forest. And actually, this has been one of the things I've been interested in looking at in the past, or seeing time periods when climate has changed, how do things like forest fires also change? And what we found is that, at least in Minnesota, just in the last 1,000 years or so, there have been very big changes in the frequency of things like fires in the prairies before European arrival sort of ended that. There was a decline in the amount of fires that had been happening naturally, and that led to an expansion of forest. And the thing that was really sort of puzzling about that was that conditions had actually gotten drier. So here you have things getting drier, and that actually reduced the amount of fire. We tend to think of it almost the reverse, where dry summers might be the summers with lots of burning. But in this particular case, it might be something like the dry conditions just happen to come along with fewer lightning storms, so you had fewer fires. And so this represents a way in which climate change could lead to somewhat surprising responses.
Say, experts here gathered, the IPCC will be releasing more, obviously, in the weeks and months to come. What do you expect to hear from here on out? Any inkling, Brian?
Well, I mean, in terms of the next report really will focus on the sort of mitigation issues. And that one will be very important and interesting to listen to. I'm not entirely sure what they will include in that report, but in a way, this is the one that's going to be the key to what we try to do. The first report that came out a few weeks ago said, yes, climate's changing, and it's being driven by the effects of human activity. And this report that's just come out last week says that is having a big impact on ecosystems, on our the natural resources that we depend upon. And now that I'm really curious to see, okay, what are the suggestions for how we deal with this? I think that's going to be one that I hope a lot of people really take to heart.
Well, what concerns me about when we get to the mitigation process is now we start politicizing this issue.
Yes.
And this has always bothered me about climate change and the impact of climate change, that it doesn't know politics. It is not affected by politics. And we talk about ecology, but what if we talk about economics? And my thing with the whole climate change is, if we can start motivating people not by fear and not by doom and gloom, but by saying it's good environmental stewardship just to have a conscience for the next generation, then we can get maybe more done without having to take sides on issues, to say who are the winners and losers economically in advocating policy for climate change. And I just hope it doesn't get down to that. And I've already seen that start with the last release that we just saw, and that the scientists and the policymakers are trying to water down this thing, what the scientists have come up with, actual data that's showing climate change.
I agree, Craig. Brian, also one thing I too anticipate that the mitigation chapter, when it comes out, will be very intensely read. One thing I worry about, though, is most of the verbiage, most of the public discussion about this has to do with the energy sector, mitigation of the energy sector. Unfortunately, that's not the whole puzzle. I think we also need to have some mitigation strategies put in place relative to our treatment of the landscape. How do we manage the land? And we also need to have, as Craig's pointed out here, if we can have wider adaptation of this environmental stewardship ethic, then we need to have some serious consideration of conservation. What can we do from a conservation standpoint? I'm hoping that there'll be as much attention given to those sectors in the report as there is to the energy sector.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that, in a way, one of the biggest sources of energy for us, of course, is through conservation. But you're right also to point out, land use changes are one of the major factors that's contributing to this, as well as just energy usage. So, and I think that, if you look at the report that came out on Friday, they also point out that a lot of the impacts are not just the effects of climate change, but also the effects of, say, land use patterns that are interacting with the effects of climate change, or coastal development of interacting with the effects of sea level rise. And so when we talk about mitigation, it's true, there tends to be a lot of sort of hype that's driven around the idea of, reducing energy use. But there are a large number of other aspects of global change generally that need to be addressed here. I've been pretty aware of some of the studies and work looking at the effects of hurricanes. And one of the big issues there is not really whether or not global warming is going to increase the number of hurricanes, but rather, at least in this country, whether or not the continued development of the coastline is increasing our vulnerability. And in that case, that's a much more straightforward, still a very complex type of mitigation strategy, but it's not necessarily political in the same way that the energy issues can be.
Well, and I, for one, remain hopeful and optimistic that we can mitigate some of the effects. We've had a history of successful changes with the Dust Bowl days and changing our farming practices with the ozone layer and reducing CFCs, you know, we can do this as a civilization and make progress to mitigate the effects of climate change.
Well, I tell you what, gentlemen, good discussion here. Brian Schumann, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Dr. Brian Schumann's a paleoclimatologist with the University of Minnesota. What an interesting job, paleoclimatology. And, of course, we'll continue to follow this subject when the IPCC comes out with its mitigation report.
Don't know why there's no sun up in the sky. Stormy weather.
Well, when you hear a sound like that, many of us automatically start scanning the sky, at least my friends here with us. And that's not what weather forecasters want you to do, though. They'd prefer that you take cover. Tornado warning sirens are a key part of Severe Weather Awareness Week activities across the country. This week, it's Severe Weather Awareness Week in Minnesota and Wisconsin. All right, gents, I have to ask you, don't you think folks at this point know the difference between a watch and a warning?
Boy, I'd like to think so. But I mean, my goodness, I've been doing this for 35 years, and I thought people got it, but I get out in the real world, and it's just like people whistling in the wind. And to use a phrase from a movie, what we have here is a failure to communicate. And what the issue is, Kathy, and it just drives me crazy, breaks my heart, is that as close as I am to the system that can communicate and deliver and the technology we have available to put out timely severe weather warnings and the people who we just can't partner with to hear that information. And and Paul knows this from the TV market, that it kills me when we put out these accurate warnings and we get these warnings out, and then the people are on the 10 o'clock news and the reporter says, this storm struck with little or no warning. And I used to tell our TV friends, I says, this is as much of an indictment of your TV station carrying weather information as it is of what the Weather Service is doing to communicate information. Because you would have to think that if people were tuned into your station, they would have known that severe weather was coming. So I think what we're doing with the weather radio and what we're doing with siren systems and personal warning systems, we still have an information era, but we don't have a knowledge era. We have people, information is out there, but it's not shaking hands with each other. So I'm a little bit passionate about that, as you can tell, because I know with situations in particular, we've had warnings out 30 minutes before the storm got there, and the first reporter on the evening news said this storm struck with little or no warning. Apparently there's and I'm looking at
defend
Paul.
Defend yourself, Paul.
I'm looking at Paul when I say this. Apparently there's some motivational factor from the news department producer that says, how can we grab people's attention with this, because it doesn't get their attention when we say these people had 30 minutes warnings, they saved some lives. It could have been much worse.
I don't know if it's a news producer.
No, I don't know, because I'm just conjecturing, because I'm new to all of this, you know.
Mr. Hunter.
Craig has his blue National Weather Service shirt on today, I'm not going to argue with him too tremendously. You know, I can't tell you the number of times that I have wanted to take a reporter over to the corner or a producer and just say, guys, get with it here. There was plenty of warning for this storm. You know, this happens. People don't pay attention. I hate to say it. They don't pay attention. They don't pay attention to watches. They don't pay attention to warnings. We get the information out there. We issue a tornado warning for somebody, and somebody else is calling the television station saying, why are you interrupting my baseball game?
That is true.
So yeah. It definitely is kind of a user oriented issue as well, as in terms of what we deliver, as you so accurately portray, Craig.
Do you think that people just figure it's not going to happen to me, so I just don't have to pay attention? I don't know.
I do. I think a lot of people don't care. A lot of people are not weather wise, and I hate to say it. There are many that are. And in this part of the world, in this part of the country, in the upper Midwest, I think more people are weather wise and pay attention to the weather because of the life threatening nature of weather here. But overall, a lot of people just go through their daily lives, and they don't care.
The lack of attention is evident wherever you go. I've done severe weather education programs both with Craig's staff and with other university staff. And I guess our hope there is somewhat tempered. When we go speak to an audience, we hope that enough people will pay attention and take responsibility for being alert and knowing procedurally what to do, what to listen for, et cetera. And maybe that will protect their business. Maybe that will protect their school building. Maybe that will have some impact on the community in which they reside. We certainly see that people don't pay as careful attention to it as they should. One thing I have been impressed with, you know, some of this is public relations. I know we have Severe Weather Awareness Week each year. That's a given. But also, under Craig's leadership, the National Weather Service forecast offices started hosting open houses, just occasionally, but people could come through. And I think exposure to the personnel and the technology that is in place to protect them sensitizes them. So in a way, that's all about severe weather awareness and education, too, because once they've had that experience, I think they have more faith and give more credibility to the Weather Service that, you know, that system, I got to pay attention to that because that's really there to protect me. So yeah. I really think that's a good a gesture on the part of the Weather Service in recent years.
My goal was to create enough what I call busybodies, the people that have their nose in the weather and that they have some responsibility or some authority to get people to safety.
Kind of like Kathy?
Yeah, I know about that. A weather busybody. Weather,
and I just think that there's enough people paying attention that can assume leadership to keep people safe because some people are just, tell me when it's going to affect my house at my time. And unfortunately, we can't do that yet.
No. Well, but, I didn't mean to hit this. Hang on.
Weather radio.
I told you.
Homeland Security came up now, and I just saw in the paper today, something like 80,000 weather radios were distributed to schools.
Yes.
With a partnership of Homeland Security and the National Weather Service. So it minimizes the excuses that says we didn't get a warning because a weather radio, 24 hours a day, you get your weather.
Is that nice?
Yeah.
I have. Of course, mine is larger. You have a nice little portable one.
I got a little pocket size here. So then I can carry this around with me, and I can sort of say what's going on, and it's sort of like a personalized weather radio. It goes like this.
Yeah.
Well, now you put that.
That'll get you up.
You put that next to your bed at night. You'll get a warning, and you'll almost to the point say, I've had enough of this.
Yeah, no kidding.
But at least you can say, I had a warning.
See, Dr. Mark Seely, how about that website of the week?
Well, I've got two that are very relevant to the topic we just discussed. One is the NOAA Storm Prediction Center, Kathy, which is a fantastic resource for those that want to learn more about severe weather. Tremendous wealth of information there in terms of educational resources, as well as operational real-time resources, what areas are under threats and what types of threats. So that's wonderful. And then the other is the NOAA Weather Radio website.
Craig loves that one.
For those that travel, you can go there if you're planning your vacation this summer and you want to examine across the route you're going to take what areas are covered by NOAA Weather Radio and how to tune your radio so that you are always going to get warning information should you encounter any threatening weather. You go to that website and you can look at, you can follow your route. You can see precisely where you're going to be covered, if there are areas that you aren't going to be covered, how you should tune your radio, and it plus gives you tips on the use of your radio. So those are two very pertinent websites, NOAA, NOAA.gov, and then NWR for NOAA Weather Radio, SPC.NOAA.gov for the Storm Prediction Center. So those are easy ones, and you can even Google on the keywords and go right there if you want to do it that way.
A wealth of information, as always.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate you coming in. Thanks.
Our pleasure.
Thanks,
Kathy.
Do it
again next week. That's going to do it for Jet Streaming for this week. Mark Seely, Craig Edwards, and Paul Huttner, thank you, thank you. If you have a comment or a question for us here at Jet Streaming, go to MinnesotaPublicRadio.org, head to the Morning Edition homepage. Jet Streaming and Mark Seely's Weather Talk are on the right-hand side of the page. We hope to hear from you. Thanks again for listening to Jet Streaming from Minnesota Public Radio.
Foggy day in London town had me low